For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Introducing Lou Rockwell. He's the proprietor of the most read libertarian website in the world, LouRockwell.com. He's the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and also is the host of the Lou Rockwell Show at LouRockwell.com/podcast. Welcome back to the show, Lou. How are you doing?
Scott, great to be with you, and Obama bless you.
Oh, why, thank you very much, and may Obama bless you and yours as well. That is where blessings come from now, isn't it?
All blessings come from the state, we know that, and of course, especially the godhead of the state, the vice president.
That's right.
He scatters his blessings far and wide.
Well, you know, I have a friend.
Iraq, and now the American economy.
I have a friend who's from England, and she says that they're so much better off having a queen, because she doesn't have any real power, but people don't prop up the prime minister to be, you know, the God king of their country. He's just the prime minister, and that's kind of a point of view that we could use.
Well, you know, the great libertarian theorist Hans Hermann Hoppe, in his book Democracy, the God That Failed, that's available at Mises.org store, argues that if you're going to have a government, and Hans, of course, is an anarchist, he doesn't want to have a coercive state, but he says if there's going to be a government, you're far better off with a monarch. And all kinds of interesting economic and social arguments to show why your friend is right. But the of course, in England, they should have just the queen to get rid of the prime minister and the whole rest of the elected, the parliament and all the rest. But that would be far better. But Hans points out, for example, that there's an ownership question that in the old days the king or the queen thought of the country as really their property to be handed on to their children. And because of that attitude, they didn't seek to rip off their property. They didn't actually tax or make wars anything like democratic regimes. But with democratic regimes, the people in charge are only in office temporarily, and they have every incentive to rip off the value of the property for themselves and their friends and their families, and they have absolutely no concern about the long term. So that's just one of them, and also kings tend to think of it as the inhabitants as their people, and they just don't want to kill all their people in a war, because that diminishes the value of the country to be handed on to their children and aristocrats tend to think in very long term, so their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and so forth, and on and on. So Hoppe's book, his analysis of how the welfare state wrecks society, I mean, it's just, and why mass democracy of the 20th century sort, but it's no coincidence that it's coincided with the worst governments in the history of the world, and that David Gordon, also a senior fellow at the Mises Institute, a philosopher, points out that one of his tropes is that nobody makes an argument for anything. Everything is just assumed. But one of the things that's assumed is that democracy is a great thing, and that, in fact, democracy is the morally superior form of government. But David says, what exactly is the argument for majority rule? Why is it that 50% plus one should be able to do whatever they want, or do extensively anyway what they want, to a 50% minus one? I mean, of course, it's an outrage. Of course, there's no moral argument for it. It's just a ridiculous thing. But democracy, because people, as Hoppe points out, because people feel that we are the government. You know, we always hear Americans, and they're talking about, should we, make war in Afghanistan? Should we go back to the moon? Should we, spend $250 billion on whatever baloney project is coming out of Washington next? That's not we. I mean, the government, just one of the other things about a monarchy is everybody saw the government as a separate entity. There's the king, the court, their fancy palaces, their carriages. And when they wanted a tax increase, the regular people said, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to give those rich people my money. That's ridiculous. So there was tremendous opposition against taxation under a monarchy. in a democracy, the propaganda is, well, gosh, we're just sort of paying ourselves. I mean, the government is we. We are the government, and also the propaganda that anybody can become the president, and therefore we have no problem, any of us, in having as powerful a president as possible. Whereas in a monarchy, everybody realizes you can't become the king. There's no way you're ever going to be the queen or the prince or whatever. It's not genetically possible. So there's just many, many reasons why a democracy, a mass democracy, like the U.S., which is the biggest, richest, most powerful, most intrusive government in the history of the world, and where we have a president who carries around within the so-called nuclear football, which is the codes to start a nuclear war to destroy the world on his own say-so. I mean, that's alone unbelievably illegitimate power that no Caesar or Alexander the Great or any of the criminals of the past ever had. Mm-hmm. So the democratic potentate and the democratic state, no coincidence that it's the worst, the biggest, most vicious form of government ever to exist.
Well, you know, I think even if people...
I might add that Hitler was a democratically elected guy, too.
Well, yeah, at one point.
The communists, of course, made a big deal out of democracy. Elections and all that stuff. I mean, the democratic mythos. So this is the 20th century, and now we're in the 21st century, and I certainly hope, as we all hope and pray, that the 21st century is not some kind of replication or even worse exaggeration of the horrors of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, you know, George Bush used to like to say, this is the first war of the 21st century. Like, we're just getting started, suppose we might be. Well, it occurs to me, Lou, that when you make that argument, that obviously sounds very strange to a lot of people. And even if they're not willing to go as far as monarchy would be preferable, at least there's some, kind of, I think, really important truths that are part of the argument anyway, such as... well, the incentive structure for a congressman, for example, like you said, you know, he doesn't have any real ownership interest in the state itself. And we can see most congressmen now, even the leadership, you know, the Tom Daschle, former majority leader of the Senate, basically it's just a cash cow for him, a way for him to, make inroads into power. And then go and figure out a way to lobby for somebody else and make millions of dollars lobbying for somebody else in the Congress, that kind of thing. The incentives basically in a democracy are set up for maximum ripoff of the regular people, it seems like.
Well, of course, that's what government is, right? I mean, government exists to rip off. That's why there is a government. And, of course, Hans is not... probably not... I mean, I don't want to give the impression that Hans is an advocate of monarchy. He's only an advocate of monarchy as versus democracy, but he doesn't think there ought to be any, that, you know, he doesn't think that coercion is a good thing. I mean, he thinks, as I think, and Murray Rothbard thought, and so many others, that you can't ever morally and legitimately use violence or the threat of violence against the innocent, that that's a criminal act. And it's a criminal act if the guy's wearing a government suit, too. I mean, another sort of basic way to see libertarianism as versus other philosophies is that the government is not above the moral law. And yet, as another senior fellow of the Institute, Guido Holzman, always points out, the government is the one institution in society that holds itself out as the one that's able to break the law. In fact, that's why people go into the government, because they can break the law. So it's not a surprise these guys aren't paying taxes or whatever. They don't feel any of this applies to them. I mean, that's why cops happily speed and go through stop signs and so forth. That's the government. I mean, so that the law applies to the rest of us. Some of what's in the law is legitimate and correct. I mean, in terms of don't murder, don't rape, don't steal, and so forth. Others, it of course is entirely illegitimate. Take your shoes off and your belt in the airport and all those kinds of things. So, or give us all your money, or give us 40% of your money, or whatever the demand, accept our printed up paper tickets as money, or we put you in jail. So this kind of conduct is entirely illegitimate, and that's government, is the institution that exists to threaten violence against the innocent. That's all they ever do in this country or in foreign countries. It's why the state is entirely an illegitimate organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have a real uphill battle here. On one hand, you know, with the economic crisis and everybody blaming the excesses of free market capitalism and all that, that's probably been quite a setback to the libertarian movement. But, you know, on the other hand, or this is something I think we need to really be able to figure out a way to fix really before we can even, you know, get back to winning the what causes the business cycle argument and that kind of thing. And this is something that I really struggle with, Lou. I'm having a real problem with this. I have one particular pointy-headed left-wing friend who, no matter how many years it's been now that we argue, at the end of the argument, to her, libertarianism simply seems cold and cruel, and if you can't make it yourself, well, just tough. And it's for people who really care that the poorest and weakest among us have access to education and access to a doctor's office, you got to turn to government to provide those things. And anyone who says that those things should just be left up to freedom is basically doing so out of a belief that if you can't hack it, tough for you, period. We are cold and calculating. The government is caring and wonderful. And here's something that this kind of feeling, I guess, among people is something that I have such trouble breaking through, even though I'm the most caring guy this side of the Mississippi River. I mean, come on.
Well, Scott, of course, this is, of course, the typical argument, but all anybody has to do is stop and think about what, you know, any dealings they've had with the government. Are they warm and caring at the DMV? Anybody ever been in a Veterans Administration hospital to see what those things are like? Or, you know, Walter Reed, as we famously found out recently when looking at single-payer health care, there it is at Walter Reed. The government, Nietzsche was right when he referred to the cold, cruel monster of the state. I mean, the state is, what is the state? I mean, it's whether, you know, it's planes dropping bombs on cities or concentration camps or the IRS or all the apparatus of coercion and compulsion, all these allegedly compassionate, warm, and fuzzy things are being achieved, if I can put the word in quotes, achieved, by putting a gun at somebody's head and saying, you know, do it or I'll kill you. Well, we know what happens in private society. That's a criminal act. Even if a criminal is saying, you know what, give me your wallet because I want to give it to that poor lady over there, that doesn't justify just putting a gun to your head and threatening to kill you to get your wallet. And if he's, again, in a government suit, he's in a military uniform or one of those $5,000 suits they wear in Congress or the top bureaucrats who, of course, are the ruling class or part of the ruling class of our country, all very well dressed. When they do that, it doesn't become an act of charity. I mean, charity is necessarily a voluntary thing. And so, think about the public schools. I mean, are the institutions, these 3,000 student high schools, I mean, is the assistant principal really a warm and fuzzy principal or the senior teachers? And over, yes, you get some decent teachers in public schools. There are some decent people who work in the post office and so forth. But as institutions, they're monsters. So they are deadly to not only the cause of freedom, but the cause of social welfare and social cooperation. And it's again, the opposite of the market being, of course, a voluntary institution. And then we can go, you know, that's, of course, many other programs. But, I mean, the market, as even, many democratic socialists will admit, the market is far more productive than the government. After all, the government has, you know, no resources except what it takes by force from others.
Well, I guess the theory is, though, that without that net, that, you know what, maybe it does come down to force sometimes, Lou. We got to make sure the little kids have an opportunity to learn their ABCs. And if we just trust freedom to provide that all little kids can learn their ABCs, it might not work out. There ought to be some kind of referee there with a club in his hand to make sure that everybody pays enough to keep the schools funded enough that all the little Johnnies can learn their ABCs. That's the fear, right, is that Lou's not going to donate enough to charity and Scott's not going to donate enough to charity to provide for the helpless in a free society.
Well, I think, first of all, just to mention, you know, your point about the referee, I was like Hoppe's point that, you know, what the state is, it claims to be a referee, but it's a referee who is the judge of his own powers, not only as to who's right or wrong in a particular situation, but also he's the referee when he's one of the parties. I mean, he gets to decide about what's right or wrong when you're trying to do something, when he's suing you or you're suing him. And then, of course, he can also decide how much of your property to take to run his referee business. So this is, the referee is not exactly the word for the state. But I know that this is, of course, the result many centuries of propaganda. We're taught in the government schools and by the government-friendly media and so forth that this is the way it has to be, that people will starve. Well, first of all, there's the question that the market, of course, is infinitely productive as compared to the state, so that everybody has a higher standard of living. And, you know, are bureaucrats to be trusted more to take care of the education of children than their own parents and their own family members? It seems to me that's just crazy on its face. I mean, but, you know, I agree this ideology is very persuasive to a lot of people, and it's persuasive even against the clear facts of the situation and their own experience. Of every time they've ever had any dealings with a government official, warm and caring is not exactly, you know, the first adjectives that come to mind. So I agree we have our work cut out for us, but here we are in a period of the depression. The Federal Reserve has put us into another Great Depression, and we have the help by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the banksters and all the rest of the rest of the bad guys. So we're in a bad time, and now Obama, of course, wants to have even more welfare programs, even more redistribution. And again, let's remember what redistribution is. It's taking from the productive and giving to the unproductive. It's taking, so, you know, therefore it discourages production. That's not a good thing in the Depression. So they're, you know, printing money by the bushel fulls and enacting all kinds of new spending programs. And everybody that Nancy Pelosi likes is going to get rich. Well, you know, okay, but to those of us who are going to be made poorer by that, not such a thing. And of course, it actually won't achieve it either. If money printing and money spending, deficit spending, spending every dime and running a counterfeiting press were actually the path to prosperity, some sort of, Soviet Union Zimbabwe combo, well, then everybody'd be rich, right? Nobody'd have to work. We wouldn't have to ever produce or save or invest. Just have the government print it all up and give it to us, and we'd all be happy ever after. That's the theoretical basis of what these priests in Washington are doing to us. So the idea that these same people who murder at will people in foreign countries for not obeying them, who are happy to put people in jail here for not obeying them, they're going after poor Barry Bonds for the crime of, you know, quote-unquote, lying to the government about whether he used steroids or not. Well, it's only his own business, or maybe his employer's business if he's using steroids. Maybe there's a contractual question with his employer, but that's none of other people's business. And because he, you know, allegedly lied to the government, this, of course, is the same institution that claims the right to lie to him, to try to trick him. But, you know, of course, for a libertarian, again, if the government can do it to you, you can do it to the government. Or rather, if you can't do it to the government, the government can't do it to you. So, you know, ask Barry Bonds whether this is a warm government, or all the prosecutors and the cops and the vast apparatus of people with guns at your head. I mean, this is the institution, the state, that if you don't pay a parking ticket, if you sufficiently resist paying a parking ticket or paying a library fine, they claim the right to kill you. So this is not a compassionate organization. It's a criminal gang. Murray Rothbard always said it's a gang of thieves writ large. That's the state. And we can have all the propaganda in the world, which is, I'm sorry to say, so effective with so many people, but it does not change the nature of these people. They're criminal.
All right, well, let's get to what I think is one of the most important myths in our society. That it just has such wide-reaching consequences. I think if you just grabbed Lou a gaggle of Democrats somewhere and asked them when the Federal Reserve Act was signed, they would probably guess, because nobody really knows, they would probably guess in the 1930s as part of the New Deal to smooth out the dangerous excesses of free market capitalism. I must have learned this probably the first time, I think, in fifth grade. And then, of course, through middle school and high school. Freedom is such a wild and dangerous thing. It gets way too far out of control, and you need government to smooth out the booms and busts and the wilds of the free market. And virtually our entire society accepts that narrative. And so I was just wondering if maybe you could refresh people's memory a little bit about what exactly caused the crash of 29 and what caused the Great Depression that came after it. And then, you know, perhaps maybe we could apply some of those lessons to where we are today.
And, you know, Scott, I don't actually think everybody's buying it, so it's one of the reasons I'm optimistic, despite all the wreckage around us. But, as you know, the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, signed by Woodrow Wilson, although it was a Democratic president, but it was backed by William Howard Taft, who'd been his Republican successor, and all the Republicans were for it, too. And it was a bill that was actually drafted at J.P. Morgan's private club on Jekyll Island, Georgia, where you can go to visit today. It's a hotel. You can see the room where they wrote the Federal Reserve Act, and they hired a professor from Harvard to actually draft the legislation. It was drafted by representatives of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and of the Morgan interest, and other big banks. And I don't want to break anybody's civics class illusions here, but these guys were not interested in the public interest. Set up a central bank and got the government to pass it for them as a special interest ripoff, which benefits the banking industry, which indeed it's very, very beneficial to the banking industry. And so what happened, so then you have an institution that can just create at will, do it through the banking system. And in those days, they actually, I'm going to back up here a little bit. Today they can create money at will. Then there was a limitation because we still were on a gold standard. So we had a huge amount of inflation as the Federal Reserve to fight World War I. So I sometimes wonder, you know, governments fight wars to inflate, or do they inflate to fight wars? Or is it just a common, I don't know, they love inflation, counterfeiting, and they love war.
That certainly is the riddle.
They love killing people. But anyway, so there was this huge bubble that was caused by this, when you have this sort of artificial inflation, artificial money creation going through the banking system, it causes a bubble. We've just recently seen a bubble. It caused all kinds of malinvestments, what Mises called malinvestments. It causes things that seem to be smart investments at the time, but then when reality returns, when the bubble breaks, turn out to have been disasters. So as always happens after a bubble, there was a reaction. And in 1920-21, there was a very sharp depression. One of the deepest depressions in American history, by the way. How come nobody ever talks about that? Well, as Murray Rothbard pointed out, nobody ever talks about it because it was over very quick. If you look on a graph, it goes down very, very fast and then comes up again fast. The reason that nothing happened, even despite the central bank and all that, and of course the government far smaller in those days, but Warren G. Harding was the president, and even the Federal Reserve Board did nothing about the depression. And as a result, out of it very quickly. Now, tragically, the Federal Reserve went on, their lesson from that was, hey, let's have a party, and they created all kinds of inflation during the 1920s. There was a long artificial boom during the 20s, and you had people in the stock market. You had stocks going far too high. That was a bubble. You had a bubble in Florida land prices. You had a bubble in commercial real estate, all kinds of bubbles. And then those bubbles broke, and we returned to reality after 1929. Now, despite the propaganda that Herbert Hoover was a free market guy, he was actually an anti-free market guy. And Herbert Hoover's and the Republicans' response to the break of the bubble was the sort of first New Deal. I mean, Roosevelt only really followed Hoover's example. So Hoover had a horrible agricultural program, for example. His view that falling prices, which was one of the results of of a the breaking of the bubble was the cause of the depression, and therefore the government should do everything possible to raise prices. It's of course insane. He bailed off failing banks, he bailed off failing industries, and in agriculture, he sought to destroy crops. I mean, he actually, with all the hungry people in the world, he actually paid farmers, and by the way, forced farmers, they had to take money, to destroy their crops, to kill a certain number of their cows, kill a certain number of pigs, plow under every other row of plants in their fields. I mean, just, you know, this is, of course, government, right, destroying food.
Trying to drive up the price, right, because they said the price was so low that all the commerce had broken down. They needed to get it higher enough that people could sell some things.
That's right, and lower prices, the one thing we get out of a depression. That's the one thing they have. Whatever money you've got left goes further. Needless to say, the government, the Fed, always, then and now, do everything possible to try to bring prices back up and penalize us in that way, too. And today, there is no gold standard, thanks to what Franklin Roosevelt did, thanks to what, by the way, Roosevelt also turned this Great Depression into 1929 into something that lasted until 1946. We didn't get out of the Depression until 1946. And by the way, the war, killing people and destroying property, I know this is a shock, is not an economically productive thing to do. So the war did not get us out of the Depression. It was only the vast shrinkage of the government that magnificently took place in 1946. Robert Higgs, shows that 1946 was the greatest year of economic growth in the history of the American people. 30% of real economic growth in one year. Unbelievable explosion of creativity and productivity when the government massively shrank after the end of the war. So right now we have, they've created, the Fed and the politicians have created another bubble, another bust, we're in another depression, and we're building on the basis of an even bigger government, and of course Obama and are doing everything designed to make the depression deeper and longer. Maybe that's not their intention, but that's the effect of what they're doing. But, you know, unlike what happened in the 30s when there was virtually no dissent, I mean, there was Mises in Europe. There was Benjamin Anderson at the Chase National Bank. There was Garrett Garrett. There was John T. There were a few opponents of what Roosevelt was doing economically, but really there was virtually no opposition. I think today there is significant opposition. I mean, Ron Paul has stirred up just a magnificent number of young people to be interested in the Federal Reserve and understand what kind of a monster as a previous incarnation of the Fed as a monster, what kind of a monster the Federal Reserve is, why it causes depression. More people are aware of it. And you know, when they got away with their TARP bailout, the Bush bailout, with, by the way, hysterical Soviet-style press propaganda, pass the TARP or we're all going to die, you know, pass it. If you remember that, I mean, every single program, every single commentator, it was like the Nazis or the Soviet radio or television. I mean, it was unbelievable unanimity by the whole establishment.
Yeah, and we can't wait for the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Saddam Hussein's going to invade us if we don't pass this thing.
Exactly that same sort of thing. So here you have the all this propaganda, even though no regular American was for the TARP, not one. The most wonderful unanimity of the American people, class, race, gender, economic status, region, every single American was opposed to the TARP. Of course, the idea that the American people have anything to say, well, that's not the democracy. It's actually because the state that runs everything. So they got it through. But, you know, this time, there's so much more opposition. I actually think Obama's having a little bit of trouble. Now, I'm afraid he's going to get this thing passed. His so-called stimulus. It's actually, of course, a deadly thing. It's like the wasp sting. Larry Bean in a LouRockwell.com article showed about how this is etymologically where this word comes from. But it's actually a deadly thing he's doing. But there's far more opposition. Far more people know about the Fed. Far more people interested in what the government, understand what the government is doing. They don't have the unit they had in the 30s. So, you know, I actually think that there's reason to hope, even though they have just all poor. We are all poor. We're going to be poor unless, of course, you're getting a few mil from the stimulus, and or, you know, your union boss or a corporate boss, or, you know, the other members of the elite who are going to do very well from this stimulus thing. But regular Americans are all going to be poorer. So we unfortunately can't do anything about that, but we do have something to say about what happens in the future. Are we going to stay poorer, or do we have a chance of restoring some sort of decent prosperity, of not having a militaristic, imperialistic foreign policy? Obama, of course, is continuing, immediately became another war criminal by murdering people in Afghanistan and continuing to murder people in Iraq, and, of course, he's murdering people in Pakistan. President, of course, is always the murderer-in-chief. I mean, that's his actual foreign policy title. So this stuff goes on, but we don't have to accept it. We don't have to have it. And I think among especially young people in this country, there's far more rebellion, there's far more willingness to question the regime and the propaganda of the regime. They're having trouble in Washington. Of course, they're also ultimately a bunch of crooks. I mean, they're just, what an unimpressive bunch of criminals. I mean, give me the Sopranos any day. I mean, these guys are just, you know, not even entertaining while they're ripping you off. So I actually, all the trouble they've caused us, all the evil that they do every day, for when they do evil start to breakfast, there is hope.
Well, you know, part of this about, you know, the stimulus, whether it will work or not, is, well, basically the underlying argument, I think, it sort of goes unspoken, is that the bubble was good and we've got to get back to the bubble. I guess my question for you is, will that work? It seems like it did last time, when the dot-com crash, and then September 11th, they just turned the money machine on and they were able to reinflate the bubble. And basically that's what they're trying to do now. Is it going to work?
Well, you know, it did work for the government and for the regime when they did that, quote unquote, work. But what they did, exactly as the Austrian economist warned at the time, they were building up for a worse crash. That when the recession happens, another thing to think about is that the damage is done during the boom. The economic damage takes place during, doesn't seem like it. It's like, I don't know, being drunk and then being hungover. If you're actually doing the trouble is happening when you're drinking, not when you stop the drinking, even though you feel bad then. So all the damage is, that's when all the crazy investments are made. That's when people get crazy mortgages they shouldn't get. That's when they buy far too expensive houses. That's when shopping malls open that shouldn't open, and just a million and one different examples of this. The correction happens during the recession or the depression. That's when the mess on the floor is mopped up. So to the extent that the government won't allow the floor to be mopped up and all the wreckage to be picked up and rebuilding to start, which is what exactly, as you point out, what they did during the dot-com bust. This is why Clinton is to be blamed for the beginning of this. Can they do it again? You know, I can't actually be 100% sure they can't do it. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I think that they're just going to cause us unending economic troubles. So what's happening is they're doing all this inflation. They're printing money like crazy, like Weimar. We're not seeing the inflationary impact yet, that is the price increases, I should say, because increasing the money supply is inflation. So we're not seeing the effects of that inflation yet in terms of prices, because banks are building up reserves. Banks are terrified of going out of business. And also, there's a credit crunch. Thank God for the credit crunch, by the way. There was too much borrowing and lending during the crazy bubble. And you're exactly right. That's what the government wants to bring back. The insanity of the bubble. That's why they want to raise real estate prices when real estate prices clearly need to fall more. It's why they want to have the party going on. You know, it's why they keep talking about extending credit. Well, you know, there was too much credit extended. They created too much credit. Too many people went too heavily into debt. Too many businesses went too heavily into debt. That has to be liquidated. So it is being, the market is, by the way, fixing things up. despite what the government is trying to do. But, you know, who knows? I mean, if they were to succeed in bringing the bubble back to some extent, it would be an extremely terrifying prospect. I mean, we're probably already in the worst depression in modern history. Created probably the worst bubble in the history of the human race internationally. The Federal Reserve and all its cohorts in the Western and Asian central banks, all coordinated by the Federal Reserve, as, you know, the U.S. being, of course, the world government. So they've already, we're already in deep trouble. If they succeed in doing it, it's a very, very scary prospect. So we actually don't want them to succeed in doing it. We actually want the correction to take place. We want the bankrupt businesses to go out of business. We want, even though that's, of course, horrible, it's a horrible thing to see a closed-up business. I mean, it's just, it literally hurts your heart to see it. People out of work and this sort of thing is just horrendous. But it has to happen in order to have a recovery, for capital to go, not be kept in the hands of the creeps in Detroit. General Motors loses $4,000 for every car it sells. Now, why would you want to keep that kind of thing going? Oh, sure, the UAW guys and all the wealthy executives at GM would like to keep the game going at the expense of the average person. But, you know, that's entirely morally legitimate and economically illegitimate. Let them go bankrupt. Let them all go bankrupt. Then those resources, doesn't mean the factories go out of existence or whatever, then those resources can be taken over by people who know what they're doing. Maybe it'd be Toyota or somebody, I don't know. Then those resources can be taken over by business people who are smart, who make profits, and then we can have a return to prosperity. To the extent that the government keeps the economy sick, which is what it's doing with its monetary and fiscal policies, then we're going to stay sick. So, I don't know, the last time it took 16 years for the to come out of the Depression. Maybe 17 years. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a very scary prospect. They're a criminal gang, and we only have to hope that they fail, that they're, even if they pass their stimulus, that it doesn't actually have the effect they want it to have, and that the market can actually attempt to solve the conditions that the state has placed on it. We're really in a, as always in human history, a race between the market and the state to see whether productivity and prosperity and human well-being advance, or whether killing and looting and lying, the other aspects of the state, whether they advance.
Well, you know, it seems like their best argument to skip past all of what you just explained and go straight to they need to do something is unemployment, because, like you said, there are real and quite horrible human consequences from what the government has done to our money. And so I guess my question is, would it be reasonable at all for someone who understands that the bubble was the problem, that wasn't good days, the bubble's what set us up for this, and this is the necessary correction, could someone accept that and still argue, not necessarily for a stimulus to jumpstart the economy and get it going again, which is, you know, code words for reinflate the bubble, but still favor kind of massive unemployment insurance and things like that, so that people's families and lives aren't completely destroyed while the transition is made between the artificial good times and the natural order of the way prices are structured around here?
You know, it's interesting. It was always Mises's point that economics is a value-free science. That is, economics can tell you that if you have, let's say, what they're doing right now, they're increasing the amount and the length of unemployment payments. So if you subsidize unemployment, which is what that is, and you get more unemployment, you may like that. Economics doesn't tell you whether that's actually a thing or not. It just tells you what the results are, or it tells you that if you put price controls on, the shortages are going to result. But it may be some people like, you know, starvation. People like collectivist agriculture or whatever, and starvation. So it's possible to understand the bubble and the bust, all that, and still be for welfare policies. but they are actually not a good thing. They actually are not, again, because of course, where is this money coming from? The government doesn't have any money. If the government, if you were to say to me, how about, let's say the government sells its national parks and uses that money to pay the unemployed, I'd say, go to it. I mean, I think that'd be great. But if the government is taking from people who are barely scraping by now in order so that other people don't have to work, which is what unemployment insurance is, right? It's a welfare system. Then I think that's wrong. And of course, it's also, again, there's the old economic principle that you get more of what you subsidize and you get less of what you tax. So if you're taxing employment to subsidize unemployment, this is not a good thing. It's never a good thing, but in a depression, it's an unbelievably evil thing.
Well, and what's most important is that people understand why there were so many extra people working in housing construction, and that it's necessary that they have to go find jobs doing something else. There are just too many house framers for how many houses really need building in this country.
And, Ron Paul, in the tradition of the Austrian economist, always points out that the emphasis on jobs, which the government is always talking about, is actually wrong. I was thinking of this stuff being what Hitler did when he was building the German interstate highway system. He ordered that no ditches could be dug by mechanical equipment, that all ditches had to be dug by guys with shovels. Well, that, quote unquote, created jobs, but this is not economically a good thing. I mean, I guess you could say that there could be no freight move between, Boston and New York except by men with sacks on their backs. So you create a lot of jobs, but this is the way to poverty and primitivism and disaster. So if, and as Ron always said, you could pay some guy to dig a hole and then fill it in, dig it and then fill it in. This is not socially a useful thing. So jobs, it's productivity we need to worry about, not jobs. Of course, the jobs they're talking about creating in Washington are a lot of them, government jobs that subtract from the economy, that make everybody else poorer. So we need to ask, what should the government do to encourage productivity as versus spendthriftness? What should it do to encourage, again, of course, the whole crazy Keynesian business that saving is evil and you should spend every dime, the government should spend every dime, you as an individual should borrow every dime you can, spend every dime, go out and buy a bigger TV and so on. It's insane. And you really don't have to be an economist to understand this is crazy. And of course, Keynes was crazy. And this was one of the aspects of his insanity. Because saving and investment is what is necessary to productivity. Frugality and prudence are useful human virtues, and which of course government attacks.
Well,
you need to think about productivity, not about jobs.
It seems like, when you talk about, digging ditches and making sure that every man has something to do. And, I think of the complaints, say, for example, on the editorial page of the New York Times that the stimulus is not big enough by half and this kind of thing. If the government, I guess once we accept the premise, if we do, that the government must stimulate the economy and create all these jobs and bring down the unemployment rate and all these things, there's really only one public works program that they can do that will, so-called stimulate, as in, driving up the demand for all the people who are standing around, and that is war. And it seems like they all kind of are, like Paul Krugman will mention it. He won't say, well, we ought to have a war now, but he always kind of, at least frequently, in the New York Times mentions, World War II was really good for this. And I guess this gets us back to our riddle, or your riddle, about do they inflate to have a war or have a war to inflate, and the vicious cycle. And it seems like, like in G.A. Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, almost the whole book is about war. And that's his whole thing, is that the central bank, above all, wants to have a war, because then, it's an excuse to create a massive bubble.
Well, the central bank, no question, has blood on its hands. If it weren't for the central bank, there could have been world wars in the 20th century to the extent that these you can only have a world war with central banking. because the government can't possibly tax or borrow enough to run those kinds of mass destruction operations. But as to, you know, I mean, does war, these people, yeah, they see war as a benefit. Like, you know, and I guess Roosevelt, by killing the unemployed, reduced the unemployment rate. Well, you know, and he also drafted 11 million men into the armed forces. So, that, yeah, he lowered, you know, the government unemployment statistic. Well, that's great. But, you know, it's, of course, what this is slavery, military slavery. So temporary slavery, but slavery nonetheless, and maybe the worst kind of slavery because you're, people are shooting at you and you're shooting at people you don't even know. So it's, but it's true. Krugman is a monster. Krugman, and of course, the answer for these people, Doug French always says that we have to, you know, stop using the word trillion. Now they're gonna make that like million has become a nothing, billions become a nothing. Now a trillion will be a nothing. We need to think about the quadrillion. So yeah, Paul Krugman, if the $1 trillion isn't won't do it, then we need a quadrillion or a quintrillion or whatever, a terabyte of dollars, whatever to sprinkle on the economy. So, but of course he's like all these people, actually a killer. So yes, he looks forward to war. War, of course, is the government's favorite activity. All of a sudden, disagreeing with the government makes you unpatriotic. You have to shut up. You have to turn over your children. You have to turn over all your privacy, all social authority and whatever to the state apparatus. And this is, you know, they all refer to the good war and this kind of thing. This is no war is a so no war is ever a matter of prosperity. Mises said, look, it's like a cholera epidemic. I mean, maybe you could look at the undertakers and the doctors and the farmers and say, hey, they're having a boom and they prosperity. Well, not really. A cholera epidemic is not good for society. A war is not good for society.
Well, you
but
know,
all
here's
you have to get to know about the state is they think, you know, that they revel in killing people. I mean, it's 10 times a million.
Well, you know, the irony here is, like, you think of somebody like, I don't know, Richard Pearl or Bill Kristol. I mean, these guys are just sick, evil bastards. But if you look at somebody like Paul Krugman, I mean, I've never met the guy, but I know a guy who's friends with him who says he's a really great guy. And really, the monster that is Paul Krugman is just, he's in effect a monster because of how poorly thought out his ideas are and the consequences that they lead to, right? Or I don't know, was he a big cheerleader for the Iraq War? Maybe I don't know.
No, he actually was a good guy in the Iraq War. I have to give him that credit. On the other hand, he does seem to be calling for a new war now. But, you know, Stalin had an operatic-quality singing voice and had wonderful taste in music, had huge knowledge of music, and, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people who thought he was a great guy. There indeed were plenty of people who thought Hitler was a great guy.
I guess it's a good thing Krugman's only at the Times then and not in power.
Well, he'd like to be in power, wouldn't he? So don't get to be to the top of the state without having charming qualities. I mean, I'm sure Obama's a charming, interesting guy too. But it's and people tell me Bush was a very nice guy in private. If you were talking to him, he was just a charming nice guy. But again, what is that? That's actually no excuse, and it's actually a, you know, you can't excuse these people. So it's true, Krugman's not killing anybody, but he's a cheerleader for global poverty, for the global state, and for global slavery. So, you know, the fact that he might be an interesting lunch partner, I'm sure it's true. He's obviously a brilliant guy. He's a very good writer, especially for an economist. Especially for an economist, he's unfortunately a very good writer. He's a compelling writer, but I'm sure the devil is we know the devil is a very persuasive guy. So that again is not that really is not anything in his favor.
Yeah. Well, if it means anything to me, I guess it means that he ought to be able to be argued with and convinced about stuff. If he really is a decent guy, then maybe he could lose an argument to Robert Murphy and say, well, wait a minute, maybe you're right, Robert Murphy. What do you think?
Huh.
I want to try to arrange a debate between those two.
You can't rule that out, right? People can reform. People can change their minds. So, yeah, you can't hold out that Paul Krugman may not become a good guy. It's possible. And of course, there is such a thing as intellectual error. I mean, there is power lust, which is the basic drive for all this stuff. But people, is he actually a genuine Keynesian? He probably is. I mean, somebody who actually thinks that the market, in the famous example, is like a truck running down a mountain road, and if you're not careful, it can go around the curve too fast and go off and have a wreck. So you need the firm, strong hand of and prudent hand of government, the wheel and at the brake and at the accelerator, to make sure that the truck gets to its destination but doesn't go crazy. Well, I guess the people in the gulag or the concentration camps in Germany or whatever, I guess they were, honestly communists or Nazis or whatever, but somehow not a very satisfying thing.
Yeah, well, we certainly, it is an interesting paradox, as you mentioned, how there are more people who kind of understand how the business cycle works and the whole cause and effect thing going on here than ever before. But at the same time, the big myths have all been really reinforced among everybody else, it seems like. So it'll be, one hell of a battle from here on out, whichever way it goes, I guess.
Yeah, but it's fun to wage an intellectual battle. It's fun to uphold the truth. It's fun to raise the flag of freedom, especially in a time when that's considered politically incorrect. So not only are we obligated to try to teach the truth and try to save ourselves and our fellow human beings from the depredations of the state, but not only do we have many more allies today, infinitely more allies than we did when I was your age. I mean, the fact that people know about the Fed, are interested in the Fed, hate the Fed. We have a moral obligation to fight, but I also argue it's fun to fight. And so, yes, we have a big battle ahead of us, but there's fun in the battle.
All right, now to wrap up here, Lou, tell us about the book, brand new, The Left, the Right, and the State.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, and it's available at Mises.org, or if you look at my archive on LouRockwell.com, in any of my articles, there's a picture of the book, and you can just click on it. But it's, in this book, basically, I argue that I have two threats, two excuses for statism, left-wing excuses and right-wing excuses, and both those people would like us never to consider the key, in fact, the only question in politics. When is force justified? That's the only question in politics. So the right wing wants us to worry about, flag burning or Barry Bonds taking steroids or Michael Phelps smoking marijuana or whatever is the latest thing the right wing would like us to worry about. The left wants us to worry, the poor, unemployed, or whatever. But nobody ever wants to say, when is it justified to put a gun to somebody's head and tell them to do it? That's the only question in politics. Everybody avoids it. And so what I'm saying in the book is that's what we as libertarians have to entirely focus on. Even Beltway libertarians want to ignore that. They want to talk about, dynamism or cultural issues or whatever. And these are all interesting questions. But the only key question for us as libertarians is, when is force justified? And of course, I would argue the initiation is never justified, although retaliatory force can be justified. But so I just want us to keep our eye on the ball. The ball is the state. The state is the enemy of mankind, the great earthly enemy of mankind throughout all of our history, despite the lying propaganda about it. So all I'm saying is the book, there are good things, by the way, about people on the left, and I talk about that. There are good things about people on the right, and I talk about that. But we as libertarians, we can join with the left sometimes, we can join with the right sometimes on various issues, but we are the people who have to keep our eye on the ball, that is this apparatus of compulsion and coercion, the state, the gang of thieves writ large. When is this thing justified? And of course, I would argue, it's never justified. But again, this is the one issue nobody ever wants to talk about. They always want to talk about extraneous things. our job, and this is, I'm simply, of course, copying Murray Rothbard, it's our job to keep our eye on the state.
All right, everybody, that's Lou Rockwell. He's the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's the proprietor of LouRockwell.com. That's L-E-W, Rockwell.com. You can hear his radio show there and keep your eye on the blog. Again, the new book is The Left, the Right, and the State. Thanks very much for your time today, Lou.
Thank you so much, Scott.